From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. George Foreman has been very successful in the boxing ring and in the marketplace, and his father, George Foreman, is no slouch either. Head on Only a Game, George Foreman III opens a new boxing gym. Also, the Southeast Conference's first black basketball player tells his story. A new study takes the luster off the highest of the high-tech football helmets. A Tampa organization comes under fire for sending homeless workers to sports venues for no pay. And a preview of this week's MLS Cup Final. Also ahead, remembering a legendary yet approachable Montreal Canadien.
He was always very dignified. He was very elegant. He always had time for people. He remembered your name. He would look you in the eye. And there was just something very magical about being in the company of Jean Béliveau.
Stay tuned. Sunday afternoon at their home field, the Los Angeles Galaxy will attempt to win their fifth Major League Soccer championship. Their opponent will be the New England Revolution, winners of no MLS championships, though they are making their fifth appearance in the final. The Galaxy, late the employer of celebrity soccer star David Beckham, now feature Landon Donovan, perhaps the most accomplished U.S. player ever, and Robbie Keane, this year's MVP. So is it Goliath versus David? L.A. midfielder Robbie Rogers doesn't think so.
No, not at all. I mean, they're a big club. They have great support, they have great fans, and they have great players, so I don't think it's at all like that.
The Revolution was energized mid-season by the arrival of Jermaine Jones. A veteran of Germany's Bundesliga, Jones fueled the run that has brought the Revolution to the point where they can cast off the label of not quite good enough. Midfielder Lee Wynn has enjoyed his finest season, and Charlie Davies, whose career was temporarily derailed by a serious automobile accident in 2009, has come back in spectacular fashion. Perhaps this is why New England head coach Jay Heaps, who played for the Revs when they were coming up just short, claimed neither he nor anybody else is thinking about the past.
You're not looking at history right now. We're looking at this as one game. We want to stay focused because it's been our motto all year, and every role the ball matters and every play matters, so we want to stay focused on it. We'll have plenty of time to talk about what it means later.
Galaxy head coach Bruce Arena is also inclined to disregard history in general, and in particular the game on July 16th when New England was in the middle of a seven-game losing streak and L.A. beat them 5-1.
They're probably going to have three or four different players on the field, and we'll likely have three, four, or five different players on. That game means nothing. That's in the archives now.
This final is rife with subplots. It will be Landon Donovan's last game, and though his teammates no doubt would like to send him home a winner again, they all claim that would merely be icing on the cake. No kidding. Here's Robbie Rogers.
We'd love to kind of give him that little icing on the cake.
And Omar Gonzalez.
You know, that's just icing on the cake.
And A.J. De La Garza.
Hopefully we let him go on a good note.
Well, I'm sure if A.J. De La Garza had talked a little while longer, he would have said icing on the cake. Meanwhile, the owners of the Revolution, one of the few teams still playing on artificial turf on a football field, have been making noises again about building an authentic soccer stadium. Fans hope a championship will accelerate the long-overdue development. Perhaps that anticipation helps to explain the excitement New England captain and Portuguese native José Gonçalves brings to the game he says he'll be treating just as seriously as he'd treat the Champions League final.
For me, it's as big as playing a Champions League final, you know. I respect that a lot, you know, it's a final, it's a big game. Everyone wants to be here, you know, but there is only two teams.
Either the Galaxy or the Revolution will hoist the MLS Cup in Los Angeles on Sunday afternoon. On Wednesday, Ohio State football players and coaches paid their final respects to Costa Karageorge. The walk-on nose tackle died last week, apparently a suicide. His family has linked his death to the long-term effects of concussions. Concern over concussions suffered by football players has led to the development of new helmets, which, according to some researchers, can diminish the dangers. As Patrick Ruby wrote for Washingtonian magazine this week, those researchers may be wrong. Patrick, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me again.
Stefan Duma is the researcher at Virginia Tech who has led the study designed to determine whether better helmets can cut the risk of concussions. Tell me about how he and his colleagues have gone about trying to figure that out.
First, they started out with censored helmets on the Virginia Tech football team. Mm-hmm. And then there were censored helmets on other college football teams as well. And what they were doing is they were recording basically the force of impact and hits and tackles, contact on the field and in practice. And then they were trying to correlate that with actual recorded concussions. Then in the laboratory, they're taking crash test dummy heads, essentially. They're putting helmets on them. And they're sort of trying to recreate those types of hits.
Duma and his colleagues award 5 stars to those helmets that offer the greatest protection, at least according to their tests. How have manufacturers responded to the so-called star rating system?
When the star ratings first came out in 2011, the manufacturers, they were a little cold on them, I would say. A couple of them actually were pretty critical. But a couple of years later, what you see is that more and more of these helmets are getting higher and higher star ratings. The helmet makers are essentially designing their helmets to get good star ratings. You know, consumers, quite rightfully, parents, players, if someone is telling them, hey, science shows this is a safer helmet, who isn't going to want to buy that? But as I get to in my story, it's not that simple.
Well, that's the part I want to get to. Don Comrie runs a company that helps drug firms design clinical trials, and he has characterized Professor Duma's research as garbage in, garbage out. Why?
He's pointing out that there's no way that these concussion numbers that they are recording are even close to what's actually happening on the field. I talked to Comrie, and one of the examples he gave is, yeah, so let's say the concussions they are recording are the most obvious ones, the huge knockout blows, the ones that no player can hide, no trainer can miss, no coach can overlook. Well, if you tend to be picking up those kinds of things, then maybe in your formulas, your math formulas you're creating, you're basically biasing it towards, okay, only these certain types of really high velocity straight on hits are the problems here. Let's design our helmet accordingly. But what if concussions are also happening with lower velocity hits? What if you're missing those? You might be coming up with helmets that aren't actually reducing risk whatsoever.
One obvious problem with a star rating system would seem to be that it does not take into account what's called rotational acceleration, that is, hits that cause the brain to rotate in the skull. Has Duma responded to that criticism?
Yeah, this is not just a star, but right now of every safety rating we have for football helmets, right now, none of these systems account for that rotational acceleration. You know, all hits basically produce both linear and rotational acceleration. A lot of scientists think that rotational may actually be more connected to brain damage. The brain is kind of like a blob of jello or silly putty. And when it gets that rotational twist, there actually can be more damage. Duma is definitely aware of that. You know, they're going to try to incorporate rotational acceleration into their star ratings going forward. Other researchers are working that as well. What I learned in this story is that the more you dig into this stuff, the more you realize these scientists who are all really well-intentioned, there's just a lot they don't know. My takeaway as a reporter was that this is a good idea, but it may not be as far along as parents, helmet makers, TV stations, all of us think it is.
Patrick Ruby wrote, "Can a Better Football Helmet Save Your Kid's Brain?" for Washingtonian Magazine, and you can link to that story at onlyagame.org. Patrick, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
A recent investigative series by the Tampa Bay Tribune has revealed that a local organization called New Beginnings was sending homeless people to work unpaid at Tampa Bay Buccaneers and Rays games, among other places. I'm joined now by Tampa Bay Times reporter Will Hobson, who broke this story last weekend. Will, please describe New Beginnings and its mission as presented by its founder, Tom Acheson.
New Beginnings, as it's described by Pastor Tom, is a work therapy program to help homeless folks and those battling substance abuse and mental illness back to stability and employment. And they do this by taking them in, giving them shelter, signing them up for every stream of public revenue they could find, and then sending them out to work, first around the property, doing things like raking leaves and cutting the grass, and then off the property to Bucks games, to Rays games, to work concessions, to direct traffic to the Daytona 500, to clean up. These gentlemen work 6 to 8 hour shifts. They don't get any money. The money goes to New Beginnings. And ostensibly, that covers their $600 a month program fees. And whatever they're owed is kept for them and given to them when they graduate. However, we've heard from a number of folks that they never get that money. Mm. It stays with the program.
The sports connection here is that sometimes the men and women whom New Beginnings is helping have worked concessions at pro sports events in Tampa, though the Tampa Bay Rays have recently ended their relationship with New Beginnings. What has the nature of that connection been?
The concessions companies, Center Plate for the Rays and Aramark for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, they both have fundraising programs where they let local nonprofits send work crews to volunteer their time at concession stands, and these volunteers don't get paid, obviously. A percentage of the revenue from that stand then goes back to the nonprofit. These concessions companies were not aware, however, that in New Beginnings' case, the volunteers were actually homeless people working for their shelter. Center Plate Concessions Company, according to them, explicitly prohibits sending volunteers who are dependent on the charity for shelter or food or another necessity of life. So Center Plate has canceled their relationship with New Beginnings, and Aramark is reviewing the relationship.
Is anybody claiming at this point that the Bucks, the Rays, the Lightning, and other organizations with which New Beginnings has been associated bear responsibility for the way the workers have been treated?
Nobody's made that specific complaint or criticism, but it's certainly one that could be made. I mean, they're not being employed directly by the Bucks or Rays. They're employed by concessions companies. However, I'm sure the concessions companies pay the Bucks and Rays a good amount of money for the right to operate. Of course, what is questionable is that work therapy is being utilized by for-profit companies, and it is generating revenue that is not finding its way back to the actual people doing the work.
Pastor Tom is also the recipient of the Social Security checks due to the people who are living there, as I understand it.
Yes, he has everyone on the way in sign a contract agreeing, first off, that they'll work to cover their costs if they don't have the money, and also that any mail addressed to them will go to him. Supervising finances is common in substance abuse treatment centers because sums of money can be temptation for relapse. But there have been a number of complaints from folks that they aren't getting their money back when they're done. When they've graduated the program, they're not getting the money they should be owed. In our first story, we documented a gentleman who went to police with that specific complaint who miraculously withdrew charges when Pastor Tom decided to pay him off.
The Lightning and the Rays no longer partner with New Beginnings, and Hillsborough County officials have recently suspended a $64,000 grant to the organization. There have been calls for a federal investigation as well. Do you foresee further change for New Beginnings and its residents/concession workers?
I can't say. I think there are a lot of folks who want to know more about this agency and exactly how much money's flowed through there and exactly where it's gone. And, you know, we're going to keep reporting on it, and if we find certain answers, then there could be some more change for New Beginnings.
Will Hobson's investigative series about New Beginnings appeared recently in the Tampa Bay Times, and you can find links to those stories at onlyagame.org. Will, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jean Béliveau died on Tuesday at the age of 83. The 13-time All-Star played in the NHL for 18 full seasons, during which he notched 1,219 points. He helped the Montreal Canadiens win 10 titles as a player and 7 more as a front office man. As a result of his staggering success, his name appears a record 17 times on the Stanley Cup. But if you ask the people who knew him on and off the ice, they will tell you these accomplishments are but a small part of the Jean Béliveau story. Here to remember Béliveau is Dave Stubbs of the Montreal Gazette. Dave, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me, Bill. A pleasure.
Despite his unbelievable athletic success, Béliveau is perhaps as well known for his philanthropic work. Tell us about his decades of service, because he raised an awful lot of money for charity.
Well, he certainly did. As he was nearing his retirement as a player in 1971, the Canadians told him, look, we want to give you something. We want to do a special night for you. And he said, listen, if you guys want to organize a little something for me, that's fine. But if you raise any money at all, please, I want to create a foundation and I want to put it to good use. They wound up raising more than $155,000, and they presented him with a giant check on center ice on the 9th of April, 1971 at the Montreal Forum. Mr. Béliveau immediately put it into a foundation, and over the years, he wound up donating finally more than $2 million to children's charities. He had a great soft spot in his heart for disadvantaged children, for physically challenged children. To watch him work with these young kids and to see these young kids flock to him was something incredibly special.
Jean Béliveau was 6'3" tall, pretty big for the time that he was playing, but you describe him in your piece as a sort of gentle giant. If that was the case, what accounts for his ability to thrive in the rough-and-tumble NHL of the 50s, 60s, and early 70s?
Well, it was pretty hard to hit what you couldn't catch. He had a very, very smooth stick-handling style. He was a wonderfully graceful skater. One of the things about his skating is that he was so graceful and he made it look so effortless that Montreal Canadiens fans, bless them, would boo Jean Béliveau on occasion because they thought he wasn't putting out enough effort. It didn't look like he was working hard enough. Well, the fact was that he was such a brilliant skater and could cover so much ground with few strides that he never really had to look like he was working that hard, and he certainly became an icon and very much the face of this organization for decades.
Among the qualities that made Jean Béliveau such a huge star were his charm and his good looks. I need you to tell the story of Hall of Fame goalie Glenn Hall and his starstruck wife, Pauline.
Glenn's late wife, Pauline, absolutely was head over heels in love with Jean Béliveau, and it drove Glenn Hall crazy. He said, "For heaven's sake, don't you understand he's trying to take food off our table? Don't you understand that he's trying to take my head off with the way he shoots the puck?" And all that Pauline Hall would say was, "Glenn, I'm sorry, I don't care. One heartbeat, and I leave you for Jean Béliveau." And she was not alone. There was one woman who decided to try to drive a wedge into the marriage of Jean-Elise Béliveau, and she called, and Elise answered. She said, "Wouldn't you like to know that your husband's out tonight gallivanting around, you know, tomcatting through the streets, and you shouldn't understand this, and how silly are you?" And she said, "Well, why don't I just hand you the phone to Jean? You can tell him yourself." So there were some wonderful stories over the years, and they had a marvelous storybook marriage. They were soulmates for 61 years.
There are few professional teams with a fan base as loyal and appreciative as the Montreal Canadiens enjoy. How are folks in Montreal reacting to the passing of Jean Béliveau?
You know, if this entire city could be flying at half-mast, it would be. And there are a number of things that will happen. On Sunday and Monday, Jean Béliveau will lie in wake at the Bell Centre, and fans will be able to come in and pay their final respects, as was done with Maurice Richard in 2000 when the Great Rocket was lost. As we learned of Mr. Béliveau's passing, the high in Celsius degrees in Montreal hit 4, which, of course, was Mr. Béliveau's jersey number. And some people are saying maybe Le Gros Bill, as he was known, is looking down and just sort of having a big look at the city that was very much his adopted home for more than 6 decades.
Dave Stubbs is a columnist for the Montreal Gazette, and you can read his remembrance of Jean Béliveau at onlyagame.org. Dave, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me, Bill. A pleasure as always.
There aren't too many college basketball programs where the notoriety of the players is eclipsed by that of the scorekeeper, but reporter Ann Marshall recently found that it happened in Louisville.
On a rainy Sunday, hundreds of Bellarmine fans collapse umbrellas and hand over their tickets.
Enjoy the game.
All right.
It's the first home game of the season for the Bellarmine Knights men's basketball team. Inside, players in crimson and gray warm-ups complete drills. Cheerleaders rehearse in a huddle.
1, 3, 5, 7.
Charlie Knauer, a cheerleader with long blonde hair tied up in a white bow, looks around Knights Hall. She easily picks out one of the most familiar faces, a woman at the scorer's table where the stats crew sits.
Oh, with the short gray hair? So you're talking about on the end? She's just been here for, like, every game. She's awesome.
She is Kaylin Ryback, a petite 62-year-old. Today, just like every game day, she wears a Knights polo shirt over a turtleneck. This season marks Ryback's 45th year on the stats crew for Bellarmine's men's and women's basketball teams. She says in that time, the game has gotten more physical, and women's ponytails now seem to hang longer, hiding players' numbers.
If I can see the front, it's fine, but if I'm looking at their backs, can't read the numbers as easily. They should all have to wear short hair, that's all. Don't have too much of that with the men, at least, thank goodness.
That's classic Kaylin Ryback, practical. When asked why she likes basketball, it's indoors, not too hot, not too cold. Why not cheer from the stands? She sings at church, doesn't want to lose her voice. Why stats? She just likes numbers. With the game about to begin, Ryback stands and claps.
This is when the adrenaline starts.
She sits back down and puts on a headset. At center court, the whistle blows and Bellarmine gains first possession. Ryback's blue eyes stay glued to the ball, her head swiveling up and down the court. She only sips water during timeouts. Back when she started on the stats crew as a Bellarmine freshman, she used a typewriter to record stats. Now, she calls out each basket, rebound, and free throw, along with the player's number. A student next to her types it all into a laptop.
Why, who was it? 24, rebound, 31. Why, 33.
Why is an attempted three-point shot. Ryback often keeps stats for the visiting team. Today, that's Findlay University. But her loyalties lie with Bellarmine. Come basketball season, she clears her schedule. No vacations. In 45 years, she's worked some 1,200 games. She's missed 2. A doubleheader 4 or 5 years ago when she had a 102-degree fever. Men's basketball coach Scott Davenport says Ryback accepts this volunteer role as if having made a vow.
I think people that are passionate
find voids in their life filled by something that they really, really take a love for. And I think she has unconditional love for Bellarmine and everything Bellarmine stands for.
Ryback was never able to play sports. She was born without ankles. As a child, you could have wrung her ankles like a rag, she says. Casts helped her bones form, but she's always walked with a heavy limp. On the stats crew, Ryback is able to connect to the team, sort of like a parent watching from the sidelines.
Oh, Chris.
When a compact point guard, Chris Whitehead, struggles with his free throws, Ryback grimaces, talking into her headset to others on the stats crew.
Well, the true point guard isn't necessarily a shooter.
That's true.
But Findlay seems to take advantage of Whitehead's off day.
Foul on 0-3. They'll foul him all day long.
That's a frustrated chuckle. She's afraid Whitehead's losing confidence. Finally, he sinks two free throws. Ryback's personally invested in this team. She and her husband didn't have children. She's grown close to several players. She attends their graduations and gets invitations to their weddings. She celebrates their successes, like when the men's team won the 2011 Division II National Championship. But she's quick to point out Bellarmine's athletes place academics first.
In some places, they might as well be a farm system of the professional leagues. But these kids are going to graduate. They're going to be successful in whatever their career field is. They'll be doctors, they'll be lawyers, they'll be teachers.
Ryback applauds that work ethic. Players appreciate hers. Morgan Clemens is a senior on Bellarmine's women's team. She's a second-generation Bellarmine basketball player. Ryback took stats for her mom and dad when they played in the late 80s. Clemens says if Ryback wasn't in her seat on game day, her team would feel a bit lost.
We're all just so used to Kaylin being there and being such a staple on that scorer's table, and so it would be weird and we'd all be very concerned, and it wouldn't be normal.
At the end of every game, Ryback's husband, Bill, walks down from the stands to join his wife. He's not sure if she'll ever sit next to him for a game.
She told me a number of years ago she was going to retire after 40, and as long as Bellarmine keeps playing basketball the way they're playing, she enjoys it down here more. She's afraid she'd lose her voice up in the stands.
Kaylin Ryback nods with a sly grin.
Amen.
For Only a Game, I'm Ann Marshall in Louisville.
Perry Wallace, who began playing basketball for Vanderbilt in 1967, was the first black player in the Southeast Conference. Even before he accepted a scholarship to Vanderbilt, Wallace received death threats from people who didn't want him there. But during his senior year, Wallace was voted the university's most popular student. He joins me from Nashville. Perry Wallace, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much.
And we're also joined by Andrew Marinus, the author of the new book, Strong Inside, Perry Wallace and the Collision of Race and Sports in the South. Andrew, welcome.
Thank you, Bill. It's an honor to be on your show.
Well, thank you. Perry, you were recruited by a number of colleges. Tell us a little bit about the exceptionally successful team in Nashville for which you played in high school, because that Pearl High School group broke some new ground as well, right?
Yes, it did. In 1966, the first year that black teams were allowed to compete against white teams for the state championship, we won. And we won after an undefeated season, 31-0.
You won most of your games before the game started, because I understand you guys had a drill where every player on the team would dunk while the players on the other end of the court watched with their mouths hanging open.
Well, we did. We would get a bit warm first, and then the show would begin with the dunks and super dunks, and was the best of the playground, I guess you would think. And it served a number of purposes, educational, but also kind of had a chilling effect.
I can imagine,
on the
yes.
other players.
Andrew, tell us a little bit about how you came to learn about Perry Wallace and why you decided that his story would make a book.
Well, I came to learn about Perry Wallace 25 years ago when I was a 19-year-old sophomore at Vanderbilt. I read a magazine article, a student magazine article, about Perry's first game at Mississippi State in Starkville, Mississippi, which you can imagine was an extremely trying experience for Perry. At the time, I was taking a Black History course, which I didn't realize at the time only existed thanks to Perry and some of his classmates who pushed for the creation of such a course in the late 60s. You know, it was back then in 1989 that I wrote two history papers about Perry. He stayed on my mind over the years, and it was 8 years ago that I decided I wanted to write a book.
Perry, what did happen when you and your teammates played on the road against Mississippi State?
Not only the Mississippi schools, but a number of others in the Deep South, these were places where there was a great deal of antipathy and antagonism to the idea of integration. They felt it was forced on them. They felt that blacks were not equal. They made that be known at the games, and with the catcalls and the screams and with the threats and with the spitting on you, and some referees, but not all of them, allowed the players to play a lot more physically against you and against me, that is to say.
Bill, if I may, the scene that I read about in that magazine article was a freshman basketball game that Perry played. And in those days, freshmen did not play on the varsity. Mm-hmm. They had freshman teams. University of Mississippi canceled its freshman games against Vanderbilt rather than play against a team that had black players. Mississippi State did not. And so Perry, and at that time there was one other black player on the team, Godfrey Dillard, played in this game in Starkville, Mississippi. The scene had been so outrageous in the first half, the racism directed at them, that at halftime of that game, Perry and Godfrey, two strong young athletes, held hands as they sat together on the bench in the locker room to gain the strength to go back out there in the second half.
Perry, did you feel more welcome on the basketball team than elsewhere on campus at that time?
I probably did, because the players and the coaches, I felt, acted in a very decent, civil manner. You think of how much more hellish my life would have been had they rejected me as a fellow teammate, or had they engaged in games, large and small, to discourage me.
Andrew, how good were the teams Perry played on, and how strong was SEC basketball at that time in the 60s?
SEC basketball at the time was uneven. You had Kentucky, which was, you know, clearly one of the best programs in the country. Perry's teams also were uneven. His sophomore year, his first year on the varsity, was the best team that he ever played on. I think they won 20 games that year, but in those days, only the conference champion went to the NCAA tournament.
When your final basketball season at Vanderbilt was over, you felt you had something to say to the college community about your experience at Vanderbilt. Tell us a little bit about your message and how you chose to convey it.
The Vanderbilt community and the larger community were not being given the benefit of the facts about the problems that black students were having on campus. I felt that a pioneer who comes back from exploring the West and just says, okay, it's cool, you know, comes back east, just dress casual. And if you see anybody who seems not to like you, give them a hug. Well, I don't think the pioneers would have been doing their job when they came back from the West. And so what I did was I finished my job, and I did it in newspaper articles, one big one with the Nashville Tennessean.
In 1970, the Philadelphia 76ers drafted you, but you ended up in law school at Columbia University, which must have been a terrific disappointment, and later became an attorney at the U.S. Department of Justice. Today, of course, you're a professor of law at American University. I wonder which you enjoy talking about more, basketball or the law?
I enjoy them both. I spent so much more time with law and some of the justice that I could contribute to that I really enjoyed probably more talking about that. But basketball was near and dear to my heart. I just don't breathe it and sleep basketball and that sort of thing. I kind of moved on.
Perry Wallace was the first black basketball player in the Southeastern Conference. He's currently professor of law at American University. Perry, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much.
And Andrew Marinus is the author of Strong Inside, Perry Wallace and the Collision of Race and Sports in the South. You can read my review and an excerpt of that book at onlyagame.org. Andrew, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, you won't believe the size of the fish this guy caught, and you shouldn't. The history of cheating in bass fishing competitions. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Size isn't everything, Bill.
In bass fishing, actually it is.
Rats.
Pretty much. Last Sunday, five members of the St. Louis Rams took the field with their hands raised. Rams tight end Jared Cook called it a message that young adults can protest peacefully without getting out of line. The NFL did not issue any fines. Does that mean the league agreed with Mr. Cook?
First of all, Roger Goodell was not planning to stick what's left of his head above the sandbags after that judge in the Ray Rice situation took most of it off earlier in the week. I congratulate the NFL for its discretion here. I certainly congratulate St. Louis Rams coach Jeff Fisher, who got up at his press conference and made quite a forceful defense of his players' right to do this. And I think, frankly, the St. Louis County Police should shut up at this point.
Minnesota Vikings running back Adrian Peterson did not testify at this week's hearing to appeal his suspension. Instead, NFL executive Troy Vincent was reportedly compelled to appear after an audio tape of Vincent telling Peterson he could be given, quote, time served after pleading no contest to misdemeanor assault was entered into evidence. More trouble for Commissioner Goodell?
Yeah, I think so. But I think that, I mean, he's sort of on a little bit firmer ground on this one. And I think, quite honestly, for all concerned, it would be better if Adrian Peterson just missed the rest of the season.
It's too late now, but teams who wish to play in the first FBS playoff had an option other than playing games against very worthy opponents and beating them all, and that option would be?
Hire a PR firm, Bill, to make your case. And that's what the Baylor Bears have done.
Well, nobody gets a concussion when they hire a PR firm rather than play, right?
Well, except truth in the English language,
All right. The confidential statement made by Florida State quarterback Jameis Winston in his university disciplinary hearing made news this week. We now know that the Heisman winner feels that, quote, rape is a vicious crime. The only thing as vicious as rape is falsely accusing someone of rape. So, where do we go from there?
We don't go anywhere. This statement is a joke. This statement was written by a lawyer. So, no, I first of all, I don't believe Jameis Winston, and I don't believe whatever lawyer wrote the statement either.
The possibility that the Philadelphia 76ers would not win a game this season evaporated on Wednesday night. The Sixers beat the Minnesota Timberwolves to avoid tying the NBA record of 18 consecutive losses to begin a season. I don't know whether to be relieved or disappointed. Actually, I do know. It was a fun story while it lasted.
Now they're just a bad basketball
team.
But I do like the anecdote that just as the game was beginning, a Philadelphia player was stepping to the free throw line, and the referee blew the whistle, and yes, wait for it, the Sixers were going in the wrong direction.
Well, to be fair, both teams were going in the wrong direction.
Yeah, but the Sixers were really going in the wrong direction.
Charlie, your favorite Canadian, and the favorite Canadian throughout much of Canada and beyond, passed away this week.
Yeah, everything Willie Mays is to you, Bill, Jean Beliveau was to me. He represented not only an enormous talent, but an enormous heart and everything that's right about professional sports. And people in Canada, I mean, he was almost named Governor General of Canada, but he turned it down. There are, you know, people who knew him better than I did, but in terms of somebody to follow, if not idolize in sports, I don't think I could have done any better than number four.
The MLS Cup will be awarded this weekend to either the LA Galaxy or the New England Revolution. The last time the Revs were in the championship game, Charlie, you came over to my house, but you kept asking if there was another TV so you could watch football. Has your attitude changed at all?
Well, obviously, there's a lot of attention to it being paid out here because it's the local team. And I know the fact that it's Landon Donovan's last MLS game means a lot. So there's a lot going on. And interestingly enough, of course, the ownership of the New England Patriots and the ownership of the Revolution are the same people, and they have both games on the same day in California.
A short helicopter ride will take them to the Pats game.
That's right. The Kraft family is going to go to the Revs game, climb in the helicopter, and go watch the Patriots play the Chargers.
On Wednesday, Elizabeth Herndon set a new world record with a time of 6 minutes, 17.76 seconds, breaking the previous mark by more than 10 seconds. I'll leave it to you to describe the event at which the 29-year-old competitive marathoner and assistant professor of geology prevailed.
It's the beer mile.
Sure.
The world championship beer mile, where one drinks a beer before every lap of the race. And Ms. Herndon ran 6 minutes, 17.76 seconds, breaking the world record. There were just some remarkable performances here.
Shout sports?
You may, yes. There were some remarkable
sports.
There we go. Corey Gallagher, who won the men's side, had the fastest chugging times. He's a mailman from Winnipeg, and he took the lead in the last lap, downing the last beer in 7.29 seconds. And no, I don't want to go in the locker room after this event is done.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland. And he joins me each week here on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Winners of bass fishing tournaments are often subjected to polygraph tests, which are meant to prevent cheating in a sport that now offers cash prizes worth thousands of dollars. David Hill has written about the history of cheating in bass fishing for Grantland, and he joins me now. First, David, briefly tell us how bass fishing tournaments work.
Well, the typical bass tournament is pretty simple. Guys go out on their boats. At a certain time, they fish all day, they come back at the end of the day, and they weigh the fish that they caught. And whoever caught the biggest load of fish wins the prize.
What are the most common ways that people find to cheat?
Basically keeping a basket of bass hidden somewhere on a lake in advance of the tournament. People will use like a pet taxi or something like that, and they'll fill it up with what they call lunkers, you know, big fish that they've caught, and they keep them stored in these things, like under a dock or something. And then the day of the tournament, they'll go out there and take them out of the basket, put them in their boat like they caught them.
I understand that some people have hatched more complicated plans, because that one sounds simple. Could you tell us the story of one competition from the past year in the UK that involved a 13-pound bass?
It was a small event. I think the first prize was something like $1,500. But the guy won it with this enormous bass, and the guy who came in second just totally by chance recognized the fish because he had been to the local aquarium with his daughter earlier that week, and his daughter had made a comment about some of the markings under the fish's eye, and he noticed those markings on this fish, so he told the judges called the local aquarium, they checked, and sure enough, they were missing a big old bass. Turned out that the guy who had entered that fish in the tournament was a former employee of the aquarium, and he had gone back and snatched it.
How much money are we talking about in the big tournaments here that people find it worthwhile to cheat?
These days it gets pretty big. I mean, the Bassmaster Classic is kind of the Super Bowl of bass fishing tournaments, and first prize in that tournament is $300,000.
Oh, okay. In 1967, Alabama insurance salesman Ray Scott tried to change the perception of the sport. How did he do that?
Well, he organized what people consider the first modern fishing tournament, and he invited fishermen from all over the country to come and pay $100 to enter what he thought would be sort of the most prestigious bass tournament ever. You know, at the time, what he was really up against, he was competing with trout fishing, which was considered the sort of more esteemed outdoor sport. He was trying to bring some respectability to a sport that I think had been sort of maligned, and he succeeded.
The sport, you write, gained popularity in the 70s and the 80s, and it was during that time that cheating seems to have become more organized. Tell us about Elro McNeil and his plan.
Well, Elro McNeil was sort of ringleader of a big cheating syndicate. They took down hundreds of thousands of dollars in a lot of major events during this sort of boom in bass fishing tournaments. And their scheme was that they would haul really big black bass from South Florida in these trucks with aerated water tanks in them. They'd haul them across the country, and then they would give them to fishermen who were entering those events to, you know, pass off as their catches, and then they'd split the money with them. Part of the problem was that the judges eventually were able to identify through the genetics of these fish that they weren't from the local area. And the four sort of ringleaders of the ring, including Elro McNeil, all got sentenced to 5 years in prison.
What's the situation like today? Are the polygraph tests working? Is the landscape free of cheating these days?
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. My personal opinion is that the polygraph thing is kind of silly, but it's still something that I think gives some measure of comfort to the people in these tournaments. They do routinely administer polygraphs to people who win big events. You know, Elro McNeil and his gang used Valium to beat those tests all the time. They also give out false positives, which I think can cast suspicion on people who don't deserve it. But I don't think that cheating is rampant at the higher levels of the sport, where there are lots of rules and there's a lot of people watching closely. And it may occur more in the smaller sort of weekend events, regional events. There are stories that come out pretty regularly about people being caught trying to cheat. But I don't think that it's something people worry about. Fishing is a tight-knit community. The choice that a lot of people have to make in those events when they're deciding to cheat is, do I like to fish more than I like $500? Because if you get caught cheating, even in a small event, you're not going to fish anymore. You know, and that's what we've seen happen to people who've been caught in events, is that not only do they sometimes have their fishing license taken away from them, the community shuns them. So it's a bigger risk than just sometimes the crime that they're committing.
David Hill is a regular contributor to Grantland, and you can link to his piece, The Weight of Guilt, at onlyagame.org. David, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me.
Ken Griffey was followed by Ken Griffey Jr. Bobby was followed by Barry Bonds. Felipe Alou made way for Moises. Wayne Gretzky's son Trevor rebelled by playing baseball and football instead of hockey. But what happens when a son follows his father in sport and in business? Only a Game's Karen Given has our story.
My dad's my best friend. I'm kind of like a chip off the old block, just a chip.
I'm sitting in an organic juice bar inside a boxing gym just across the Four Point Channel from Boston's financial district. To my left is a man whose name might just ring a few bells.
My name is George Foreman III, Big George's second son.
Let's get this out of the way. All five of George Foreman's sons have the same name. George III goes by Monk.
Then there's Big Will Red, Joe, Little George. I won't tell you his real nickname because he'll kill me. And then my two nephews. We have eight Georges now.
George III.
Cheesier.
Whether acting in his father's Doritos commercial or helping him promote his ubiquitous grill, Foreman has been following the man he calls Big George all his life.
I was wrong. Conclusive proof, 4 out of 5 George Foremans prefer the...
When he got older, Foreman served as his dad's manager. And when George III decided to step into the ring, father and son switched places.
You know, I'm 16-0 now. He was my boxing trainer and my manager. And then after like 3 years straight of fighting, I said, whoa.
Foreman's true life goal was to follow his dad and become an entrepreneur. That's when a friend suggested he open a boxing gym. He loved the idea, but...
I didn't think there was any money in it, that you could actually keep a roof over your head training people to box. And that began the idea of this, the club.
The club's full name is The Club by George Foreman III. And it's not just any boxing gym. It's a luxury boxing gym, complete with steam and sauna rooms, treadmills equipped with Google and Facebook, and more than 120 classes a week.
We're going to start in 5, 4, 3, 2, and work, let's go!
The club's signature class is BoxFit, a combination of rowing, yoga, spinning, kettlebells, suspension training, and boxing.
I heard my business partner once say, he said, cool is two unexpected things. We try to put 4 unexpected things together. So it's good. I think it's gone from cool to weird, but it's working.
Foreman's motto is everybody fights. But only 6 of the club's 1,000 members are preparing to enter the ring. In every class, Foreman and his trainers use boxing metaphors to encourage members to keep fighting through everyday life. But the most important thing to Foreman, the thing he talks about more than anything else, is creating a community. Take a class at the club and you're going to be assigned to a team. Before the class is over, you'll likely have made a friend.
All my classes are like that. And they look at me crazy, but you see the people talk to each other. They're laughing and joking. They're getting to know each other. They love it. There's no other place you're going to get this. In many ways, they don't even get it at church anymore. It's church, they kind of just show up and go home, you know?
George Sr. has built 3 churches in Texas, but on Sunday mornings in Boston, the son of an ordained minister can be found gently teaching the Southpaw stance to students, nurses, lawyers, and billionaires, some of whom look like they've never before touched a boxing glove. Foreman, who has a business degree from Rice University, has a question. If you were to assign a brand name to how you'd like to be at work, what brand would it be? Energizer, Dr. Pepper, Nike's Just Do It.
And they all ask me, George, where do you get this stuff? Do you like read a book? I'm like, nah, just call my dad.
Okay, by now you're probably tired of hearing George III talk about his dad. And he gets it. He does. Foreman seems to understand the trappings of being the eponymously named second son of the 2-time heavyweight champion of the world. But he says his father also happens to be his hero, his mentor, and his best friend.
Most of everything I do is a direct result of his inspiration, so I have to sometimes just say my buddy, a guy I know, instead of saying my dad every 5 seconds. I'm 32 years old. I got to stop that.
The George Foreman brand has sold more than 100 million grills, so it's no surprise that George Foreman III would choose to put his name on the wall. No doubt it gets people in the door. But does anyone actually stay because they want to rub elbows with a George Foreman?
It definitely intrigued me. How do you answer that one? You're going to edit this, right?
That's Ashley Kakunis. Like 70% of the club's members, she's a woman. And like everyone else I talk to, she has some pretty normal reasons for joining this gym.
I love the different kind of workouts they do. I love the fact that you can do yoga, you can do spinning, you can do the boxing. But I also love the people here and the trainers. It's definitely more of like a community here. You kind of get to know people during the workouts and you make friends at the gym.
But there's still one person who, as of yet, hasn't commented publicly about the club by George Foreman III.
I'm George Foreman Sr., by the way, and you can just call me George.
When asked whether he's more proud of his son, the boxer, or his son, the businessman, George Sr. rejects the question. He says boxing was always the means by which he became an entrepreneur. It was his jumpstart for everything. But asked whether his son is good at his job, George Sr. is unequivocal.
As a matter of fact, he comes here, I get a chance to get private training because every time he perfects something, he comes and try it out on me. I'm the biggest guinea pig he has. And I follow him on Facebook. I'm doing everything he does. I follow him.
And with his father as his number one follower, George Foreman III's next dream is to take his Everybody Fights philosophy and workouts digital so they can be shared in gyms all across the country. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is James Trout. Our assistant producer is Martin Kessler. We had help this week from WBUR's Kurt Nickisch and from Avishai Artsy at KCRW in Los Angeles. Our intern is Eric Larrabee, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word this week comes from George Foreman III, who claims that the members of his gym like spending time together when they're not training.
And the people here have their little like groups. They meet up outside the gym. They don't even invite me.
I bet they invite your dad, man. Everybody likes him. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.